as far as the minor prophets are concerned, the approach we're going to take is we're not going to go through it verse by verse. We're going to cover the 14 chapters of Hosea in two studies. We'll have kind of a background and a study tonight and cover a portion of Hosea, and then we'll finish up the book in the study we will have next week. So then, so it's the purpose is to do kind of a survey and overview of the minor prophets, and I thought it would be worthwhile going through that because I've never covered the minor prophets during the time that I've been here. So one of my responsibilities is to record this evening, so I'm going to turn that on.
Recording in progress.
There we go, recording in progress. And so then we will get into the study. And so once we're done, we'll just go ahead and move on to talking about activities and suggestions that you may have for the coming year. So I appreciate, first of all, everybody joining us this evening. So we actually have 28 online. So thanks to everybody for joining, and hopefully you'll find this profitable. So anyway, we're going to begin a survey series on the minor prophets. And in a survey, that means we're going to more or less look at highlights in each of the books and see what lessons we can learn from them. It won't be a verse by verse, chapter by chapter approach. So what I'd like to do is begin with a brief introduction to the minor prophets, so that it lays out the groundwork for the book of Hosea. So we'll do the background, and then we'll begin to look at a few things as far as the minor prophets are concerned. So the prophet Hosea probably served the longest of any of the prophets, major or minor, and I'll explain what we mean by major and minor as we go through this. But he was probably the longest serving of the prophets. How can I say that? Well, the reason we can say that is because if you look at the beginning of the book of Hosea, it talks about various kings of Israel and Judah that ruled, and Hosea served during their kingships. And, you know, there's a span of time involved. We can't get an exact amount of time, but it looks like from looking at the time frame of the kings that it would suggest that Hosea prophesied for about a period of 50 years. And so 50 years is about the longest time that any of the prophets served. So he was at being a prophet for a very long period of time. Now, as you think about the minor prophets, if you look at the Jewish scriptures and the way they've grouped them, the minor prophets are considered one book. So from our perspective, there are 39 books in the Old Testament, but from the Jewish perspective, having put done some combining of books, the Jewish scriptures have 22 books, and they're the same books as we have, but they're just grouped differently. And the 12, in terms of time, begin to prophesy shortly after the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. So we'll be talking about Elijah especially, and a little bit about Elisha this evening. And as I said, it wasn't long after Elijah and Elisha came on the scene that the minor prophets also begin their prophecies. Many of the prophets in the earlier portion of the 12 were contemporaries. That means that they all prophesied about the same time. And they actually quoted one another, and they worked at the same time. So, and they were aware of each other. And during the reign of Jeroboam II, and that's important to remember, there was the original Jeroboam, the Jeroboam the first, he is the one that led Israel as they rebelled against the son of Solomon and they established a second kingdom. But Jeroboam II comes along later on, and he had a very long reign. And Jeroboam II, his reign encompassed the prophets Hosea, Amos, and Jonah. They were all prophesying, and Jeroboam was reigning, and they were all prophesying in the kingdom of Israel. It's as you look at the minor prophets, it's very probable that Joel was prophesying in Judah around this time, and Obadiah was delivering his prophecy against Edom. So these men were all working at approximately the same time. And some of the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel, were prophesying at the same time. So you have, we've mentioned minor prophets, we've mentioned major prophets, and I'll kind of explain that. The order in which the minor prophets occur in our Bibles is probably correct. As far as the timing in which they were laid out, it's more or less a chronological grouping. They're not, so one followed the other, more or less. And that's not always the way it is with the other books in the scriptures. Hosea, Amos, and Jonah were nearly contemporary. Joel was prior to Amos. The four remaining prophets, Micah, Nahum, were later than Jonah. And Nahum actually refers to Jonah. And Zephaniah quotes from the book of Habakkuk. So moving on to the prophet Hosea himself, the name Hosea means salvation. And, you know, his name means salvation. And he shares his name with Joshua and Jesus. And as I said, all of their names relate to salvation. Joshua was a savior in that he brought Israel into the land of promise, and he led them through the wilderness and brought them into the land and helped to forge the initial stages of the conquest. And by his death, they had gained a great deal of territory in the land of promise. And upon his death, and things kind of stalled out as far as the conquest was concerned after his death. We know that Jesus came on the scene, and he definitely brought the good news of God's coming kingdom and the good news about salvation. So it would make sense that his name would relate to that subject. Hosea's name fits well with the fact that the book of Hosea, there are a large number of scriptures that deal with both deliverance and the restoration of Israel. As you go through the book, he does talk about the fall of Israel, but he also ends on a high note with talking about salvation and the good things that are to come as God works things out for Israel. So Hosea was a prophet only to the nation of Israel. And so it's good to note that because not everybody that was a prophet went to Israel. Some went to both Israel and Judah, and some went to only Judah. So you have to kind of keep track of who they're preaching to, which is an interesting understanding. Hosea was unique in that he was the only writing prophet, that is, that he wrote down his prophecy, and it's been preserved for all of us. When you look at the other prophets that are mentioned in his time period, Elijah and Elisha, they didn't write down any prophecies. We have people writing about them, but they did not write down their prophetic message for it to be passed on to future generations. So Hosea was a writing prophet, and he wrote down his prophecy, and that's a blessing where we can have it here today and we can take a look at it. There were other prophets that were sent to Israel, but didn't live in the land. They would come to the land of Israel and deliver their prophecy and then go back to wherever they came from. But Hosea actually lived in the land of Israel. It appears that Hosea was a prophet for, as I said, well over 50 years, and with his prophecies ending just before the fall of the house of Israel. And the house of Israel, as most of us know, took place in between 721 and 718 BC. So he prophesied for a time, and he came to the end of his prophetic message just before Israel fell. The remainder of this evening study is going to focus on the first five verses of the book of Hosea. Why is that? Because it's important to have the historical stage set for a number of the minor prophets. So we're going to look at some things in Hosea which set the stage for what is to come. Now, many of us know that there are two ways of dividing the prophets. There are the major prophets and the minor prophets. So we've talked about the 12 that are designated as the minor prophets. They're not minor in their messages, it's just that they're shorter books. And the major prophets we would see as Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. They would be three of the major prophets. They're longer prophecies, and whereas the minor prophets are shorter and more specific. There's also another way of dividing the prophets, and that's in a chronological way. You have the former and latter prophets. The former prophets would not be seen as prophets. We don't see them as prophets. We instead see them as historical books. But there's a vantage point that looks at them as the former prophets. And you do have prophets who are prophesying during the period of time of the former prophets. And 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings make up the former prophets. And so it's important to understand that, especially in light of the minor prophets, as you'll see. So the Samuel and Kings are history books, and as I said, they're referred to as the former prophets. And there's a simple reality that we have to understand as we undertake this study. The better we understand the former prophets, that is Samuel and Kings, the better we can understand the latter prophets. So you have to know what went before so that you can understand what comes afterwards. So the prophecies of the rest of the minor prophets rest upon the history of the former prophets. And because of that, we will see people and events and places mentioned in the former prophets referenced in the latter prophets. So we'll see some of that today. So the key point of this evening's study will demonstrate that the writings of the minor prophets, which are part of the latter prophets, are best understood if you have a good knowledge of Samuel and Kings. You understand what went on in those books, and it helps you to understand what unfolds in the later prophets. So let's read through the first nine verses of the book of Hosea, and then we'll move on into some other things that help us to understand where Hosea is coming from. So let's begin in Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." So those were the kings that ruled during the time when Hosea was prophesying. Now, we don't know when he began in the time of Uzziah. We don't know how long he prophesied during Hezekiah's time. They were all kings of Judah. And it says that he prophesied during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So he prophesied during the time of only one king in the nation of Israel. So by knowing the different kings that ruled during the time of Hosea gives us an idea of when he prophesied. Let's go to verse 2. It says, "When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, 'Go take yourself a wife of harlotry, and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel on the house of Jehu and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. And God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. So just like God told Jeremiah not to pray for Judah any longer because they had become so corrupt, you have a situation here where God is sending a message by naming the child that was born to Hosea, Lo-Ruhamah, and emphasize the point that God is no longer going to show mercy toward the nation of Israel. Verse 7, and yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword or battle, by horsemen, horses or horsemen. So he is going to preserve Judah, but he's not going to do it through the might and power of men, by armies. He's not going to preserve them in that way. And as you look at the nation of Judah, they were almost undone. The Assyrians almost conquered them. They were all the way to the city of Jerusalem, the last standing bastion of the people of Judah. And God intervened to wipe out the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, having failed to take the city of Jerusalem, and having a large part of their army wiped out, returned to their land. So anyway, God was going to watch over them and protect them. Verse 8 says, now when he had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. Then God said, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. So God is telling them in this graphic way through the wife of Hosea being a prostitute and being unfaithful, and his children being named the way they were, God is sending a message to them in this process, a message that would register with them. What we might call what's taking place here with Hosea marrying this prostitute and having his children named as they were, we could call this, might refer to this as an acted prophecy. It's something that God is asking for Hosea to act out in among the people of Israel. And there are a number of prophecies where the prophet acted out something in very literal terms. I mean, you go back and look at Ezekiel. And God told Ezekiel to lay on one side for a certain period of time and on another side for a period of time. And this was all representative of God, what God was working out with the people of Judea. So Hosea acted out a prophetic point by marrying the prostitute Gomer and by his children being named as they were in order to send a very stern message to the people of Israel. So God's focus of wrath that we've looked at here in these first nine verses, as we look at the first three verses, they're straightforward. As we look at verses 6 through 9, they're not hard to follow. However, the verses 4 and 5 are not as straightforward. And what do they mean? What point is God getting across by these verses 4 and 5 in Hosea chapter 1? So let's read them, and then we'll begin to try to explain what God is getting to when in these verses. Again, it says there, beginning in verse 4, then the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So the only way we're going to understand what's being said there is by looking at the former prophets, because we have to look at what's taking place there and in this time in order to understand what God's working out. So the story about who Hosea married, why he married her, the name of the children, why the kids are named that way, is a fairly straightforward story. But the wrath of God described in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 1 is hard to understand unless we look at the former prophets. Before we get into that, let's talk about Jezreel some. Jezreel is a city on the plains of Megiddo, you have the valley of Jezreel, you have the plains of Megiddo, and all of this is a flat area up north of Samaria. So as you go north in Israel, you go through the area along the coast, and then you break out into this area of plains that we know as Megiddo, and that all comes into play at the end of the age as we learn about the final battle that's to take place that's spoken of in the book of Revelation. And so Jezreel was a city, and it was the place where the kings of Israel established their winter palace. The challenge was that Samaria during the winter time was elevated enough to where it got pretty cold there. So they built a palace on the plains of Jezreel because it was warmer there, and it was just a more salubrious climate during the cold portion of the year. So they would go north and live there for a while during the cooler times of the year. And as I said, if you look at a map or a topographical map and of the area of Jezreel, it's a flat area, and it runs from the coast. You have the plains of Megiddo close to the coast, and it runs from the coast, and eventually breaks out into the valley of Jezreel as you move closer to the mountains in the east. So it's a fairly flat area, and it's a place that was where a number of very important battles were fought historically in the history of Israel. And interestingly, it's going to be a staging area for the end of the age, when armies are going to be gathered against Jerusalem once again. They're going to stage there and then move southward toward Jerusalem. So this is something that, this is a place that is famous historically in the past and will be famous in the future. So the Valley of Jezreel was one that extended all the way to the west side of the Jordan River. And it was a milder climate. And as I said, it was where the kings of Israel established their winter palace. So remember think back to the time of Elijah, when Elijah had confronted the prophets of Baal. They were on the mountain, and Mount Carmel, and they were having the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And so what was happening is that was over, and it was time to end the drought. And so they went out and they were looking for a sign of rain. And so Elisha was looking out toward the west and looking for rain coming in. And his servant went up on the mountain seven times, and then they saw that the rain was coming, and he told Ahab, the king, you better get your chariot hitched up, and you better be making good time to get back to the city of Jezreel, because there's going to be a lot of rainfall, and if you don't get back there in time, you're basically going to be trapped out there with a lot of rain and taking place. So that all took place on Mount Carmel. And then Ahab was to make his way back to Jezreel. And that's where Ahab and his wife Jezebel lived. So as you think about just one incident from the time of Ahab and Jezebel, you know that he lives, his palace is in the valley of Jezreel. And his palace is right next to a man by the name of Naboth. And Naboth, his property is right next to the king. And he, as part of his property, he had a vineyard. And that property had been given to Naboth and his family back at the time when the land was distributed by lot at the time of Joshua. So that had been in their family for several hundred years. And so what happens is that Ahab wants to buy the property. So he's willing to pay Naboth for that. And Naboth says, I can't do that. This is a part of my heritage. I can't sell you my property. I won't sell you my property. So if you remember the story, it's always interesting to me. Ahab is denied. And what does he do? He goes and lays on his bed and basically pouts. And so his wife comes in and asks what's up. And noticing that he seems pretty unhappy, and he tells her that this man, Naboth, won't sell him his vineyard. And so she said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. So she orchestrates this man being invited to a dinner. He comes to the dinner, and then some of the people there have been paid off to give a false accusation of blasphemy against Naboth. So they accuse him of this, and a kangaroo court is held, and then they execute Naboth for blasphemy. And so they take his property, which from God's perspective is a very, very heinous crime that God is not going to forget, as we'll see, because we'll come back to it. So, and what happens is that Jezebel killed this man and just cold-bloodedly killed him. And this is going to be something, as I said, that God will remember. In 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 1, it speaks of this, and it says, and it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which the king wanted. And this was in the area of Jezreel, a very fertile land. And as you look at the time of Ahab and Jezebel, it was a lawless time. And Ahab and Jezebel basically had done a lot of destructive policies and practices in the land. And the land was suffering under their leadership. And to give us a little bit of perspective, let's go to 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 29. 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 29. And this passage kind of gives us an overview of Ahab and Jezebel. In verse 29, it says, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king of Israel, over Israel. So Ahab was the son of Omri. Omri was a very famous king in Israel. In fact, he was recognized by the Assyrians, and they referred to the people of Israel as the Cimmerians, deriving that title from Omri. And his being a powerful king in their time, he was impressive to them, and that's how they referred to the people of Israel. so then we have, and so it says that He was the son of Omri, and he became king over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Now, Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord. So he was an evil king. God designated him so. And he did more evil than all that were before him. So he was not a very good king at all from a moral perspective. And that's the description that God gave in regard to Ahab. Chapter 16, verse 31, it says, "And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took as wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal." So one of the strikes against him was that he continued the calf worship that had been set up by Jeroboam. So that was bad enough that he didn't get rid of that. He continued it, and then he took a wife from the Sidonians. She was the daughter of Ethbaal, the king and high priest of the Sidonians. So she was steeped in the pagan religion of the Sidonians, which was Baal worship. And so she married Ahab, and it said that, and as a result of marrying her, then he began to worship Baal. And so it says that he went and served Baal. Chapter 16, verse 32, it says, "Then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a wooden image, and Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him." So these were, as I said, Ahab's credentials. So he, under the influence of Jezebel, became a wholehearted worshiper of Baal, and basically through the influence of Jezebel, the influence of Ahab, the nation began to worship Baal instead of the true God. And as a result of this apostasy, this departure from God, we are all familiar with the confrontation that took place between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And that's recounted in 1 Kings chapter 18, where Elijah confronted the 300 priests of Baal on Mount Carmel. And, so there was this contest, and the big contest was to determine who were the people of Israel going to worship. Like Elijah says, "Why halt you between two opinions? If God is God, then worship him. If Baal is God, then worship him. And you should be able to see clearly by the contest that's going to unfold between me and the prophets of Baal." So they went through this whole process of giving the prophets of Baal the chance to call down fire from heaven to burn up their sacrifice. And they went about it all day long, and nothing happened. And at the end of the day, then Elijah had his opportunity, and he gave a short prayer, and God burned up his sacrifice. And it was very clear to everybody gathered there who was God. There was no doubt about it. And, and as a result of that, then the prophets of Baal were slaughtered. So this was a good thing for Israel, but not such a good thing for Elijah, because Jezebel determined that she was going to end Elijah's life. You know, she said, "Just as you've killed my prophets, I'm going to kill you." And so she set about to do that. And basically, Elijah had finished up in this spectacular event, and now he's on the run, knowing that she's going to kill him. She said, you are dead, and by tomorrow you will be a dead man. And as you look at Ahab and Jezebel, you know, God, they were a terrible king and queen, and they were perpetrating all sorts of evils in the land. And, Jezebel sought to exterminate the prophets, the prophets of God, those who were faithful to him. And you had the, it tells us about Ahab's servant, Obadiah, who said it took 100 of those prophets and hid them in two groupings in caves and provided food and drink for them in order that they could survive the malice and the effort to destroy people who were worshiping God in Israel. So Elijah, after the spectacular event on Mount Carmel, ran for his life. And so he went south almost into Egypt and found himself in despair in a cave when God came to him and he spoke to him. And he spoke to him, interestingly, in a still, small voice. He didn't speak to him with thunder or, an earthquake or breathe fire on him, but he spoke to him in a still, small voice. And what he told him to do is, you have a job that I'm going to give you, and you are to go to carry out this job. So he's in the Sinai Desert, almost to Egypt, and God says, you're going to have to leave where you're at, and you're going to have to go northward, and you're going to have to carry out the assignment that I give you. And he tells him that, I want you, Elijah, to go northward, and I want you to go all the way through the land of Judah, through Israel, and all the way into the land of Syria. And I want you to anoint a man by the name of Hazael as king of Syria. So here is a prophet of God from the land of Israel who's assigned by God to go and anoint the next king of the land of Syria. And then he was to come, after he had accomplished that task, then he was to come back into the land of Israel, and he was to anoint a man by the name of Jehu as the new king of Israel. Now, there was a king of Israel, but God was anointing Jehu as a king, and we'll see his story here shortly. And he was also to go a little bit further south than basically to go westward to anoint Elisha as the replacement prophet. So Elisha's anointed, Jehu's anointed, and Hazael is anointed. And 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 17 gives us a little bit of detail about what's unfolding here. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 17. That verse tells us, it shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. And whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. So he's basically letting Elisha know and these other men know that there are going to be a lot of people killed in the time coming up. But God also emphasizes to Elijah, I know Elijah was very discouraged, and he says, look, you can't see them, but I've got 7,000 who are still faithful to me. So this review gives us the framework to begin to understand Hosea verses 1, 4 through 5. Again, it says there, then the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So so he's making the point that the boy that was born to Hosea's harlot wife was called Jezreel because Jezreel's mother was a harlot. And it was a message that God was sending about the Jezebel, who was a harlot herself and practiced witchcraft and was the enemy of God's people. And God was going to avenge on her the blood of all of the people that she had killed and persecuted for their faithfulness to God. He told him that I'm going to avenge Naboth and all of my prophets that Jezebel has killed, and I'm going to avenge all of those Ahab and Jezebel have slaughtered. So all of these terrible things were going on during the reign of Ahab and Jezebel, and God said, enough. And so I'm going to install new people in office in Syria, in Israel, and in the prophetic office, and we're going to take care of all of the problems that Ahab and Jezebel have brought on the people of Israel. So Jehu was introduced to us while Elijah was in the cave in the wilderness as one on whom that God had designated to be the new king. So you may know something about Jehu, but we'll seek to understand more about who he was, what did he do, and what does this have to do with God avenging the blood of Jezreel on him? And that's where we have to go next. To do that, we have to go to 2 Kings. To understand, we have to go to 2 Kings. So remember two things as we're going along. Remember Hosea 1:4, because that's why we're going where we're going. Remember also what God said to Elijah in the cave. He said, I had all I'm going to take from Ahab and Jezebel. So, I mean, you can only push so far against God. And eventually God pushes back, and God is going to begin to push back. So basically, God is saying that the mess that Hazael doesn't clean up, I'm going to let Jehu take care of what's left. And what Jehu doesn't clean up, then I'm going to have Elisha clean up. And when I'm finished, I'm going to clean up the Ahab Jezebel mess completely. And he does. It's pretty amazing what takes place here. And it is an amazingly bloody time in Israel with what is taking place here that God is directing. I mean, as you go back to that time, there were some bloody events, and I don't think, you know, we've never seen anything like it. As you go through this, it's pretty amazing, the bloodshed that takes place. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 9 and look at verse 1. 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 1. And it's interesting that in Elijah's time, Jehu is anointed. But there's a time delay here. Yes, he's anointed king. It's like David was anointed king, but he didn't become king right away. And that's what happens here. Jehu is anointed king, but he doesn't become king right away. And a little bit later on, in chapter 2 Kings 9, 1, it speaks of Elisha, the prophet. And it says that he called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, get yourself ready, take this flask of oil in your hand, and go to Ramoth Gilead. So they were, the Jehu and other soldiers were there, and they were fighting against Ramoth Gilead. And they were, and this son of the prophets, this prophet was going to go down and anoint Jehu as king. So they're all there, and this prophet shows up, and he's been assigned to anoint Jehu and to take this flask of oil and pour it on his head. Now, you know, interestingly, as I became an elder, I, you know, was aware of this particular situation and this flask of oil and pouring it on his head. So when I was called upon to anoint, I really didn't understand that. And so I thought, you know, that do we pour oil on them like this, or how does this exactly work? Eventually I caught on to that, but I was a little uncertain about exactly how to proceed. So this prophet anointed Jehu king. He took care of that, and then he fled, and he got out of the way. He got away as quickly as he could. So he commissioned Jehu to strike the house of Ahab, his master, to avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab all the males in Israel, both bond and free, so I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam. And what was the house of Jeroboam like? It didn't exist. It had been wiped out. And he said, well, I'll make it like the house of Baasha. Well, what house of Baasha? There wasn't one. The house of Baasha had been wiped out as well. And so God is going to wipe out the Ahab, his wife, the descendants of Ahab and Jezebel in Israel and in Judah. So he's going to wipe them out completely. So in 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 11, we're told that Jehu had been anointed king over Israel. And in verse 13 of 2 Kings 9, it says, then each man hastened to take his garment and put it under him on the top of the steps, and they blew trumpets saying, Jehu is king. So they all accepted that Jehu was the new king, and they expressed their allegiance to him by taking their cloaks and putting them under him and showing that they were pledging their allegiance to Jehu, and trumpets were blown to recognize him as king. So as we think about this, we have to think back a bit and to the time of when Solomon died. When Solomon died, the taxes were pretty oppressive, and the people wanted relief from the taxes, and that's the message that they sent to the Solomon's son, Rehoboam. But Solomon's son didn't listen to, and the older men, they all said, yes, this is wise counsel, so we're we would advise you to listen and lower the taxes. But Rehoboam decided to listen to the younger men, and they advised him, what are you doing? Don't lower the taxes. And so they did. The taxes stayed high, and the people of Israel felt that was oppressive, and so they decided that they had no part in Israel. And so the northern 10 tribes separated from the kingdom of Judah, and so the two kingdoms went their separate ways. And this division had taken place there, and between the northern kingdom led by Jeroboam and the southern kingdom led by Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. And as often happens, you had the two nations, the kingdom of Israel led by Ahab and Jezebel, and you had the kingdom of Judah. And what happens often, and this happened throughout history, is you seek to form alliances between one kingdom and another, and that's done through marrying members of one family with another family. So the family of Ahab and Jezebel married into the family of the king and queen of Judah. So they married one of their descendants, and so now you had descendants of Ahab and Jezebel, or Ahab and Jezebel ruling, and then one of their descendants is also going to rule on the throne in Judah. So now you have cousins and aunts and uncles in the house of Judah and in the house of Israel. And as this plays out, you have the king of Judah going north from Judah or Jerusalem to visit with his cousin Joram in Jezreel. So they're related by blood. They are cousins, and Ahaziah is going up to see his cousin Joram. So that's where we pick up the story in 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 14. 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 14. So it says here that
8:21.
So. Yeah. So anyway, we in it talks about Jehu coming after them, and Jehu ends up coming up to toward Jezreel, And so he's coming toward Jezreel. And so he's the Joram has a watchman up on the tower there in Jezreel, and they notice that there somebody is coming. And so he recognizes that who is it? And he sends out a rider to find out who it is. So the rider gets out to Jehu, who's coming up on the city of Jezreel. And so the first horseman that goes out says, what's it? Thus says the king, is it peace? And Jehu said to this horseman, what have you to do with peace? Turn around and follow me. So this guy immediately says, okay, and joins up with Jehu. A second rider goes out and the very same thing happens. And the watchman is still up on the tower looking out to see what's coming. And the watchman reported saying he went up to them and is not coming back. And the person driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously. So obviously Jehu was known to be a furious driver. So he's making his way toward the city of Jezreel. And these two riders, they basically join with Jehu and they keep coming on. So the king of Israel, Joram, decides he's going to go out and find out what's going on. So he goes out there to meet Jehu. And where does he meet him? He ends up meeting him on the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. I mean, you couldn't have a more appropriate place for this confrontation to take place. So he comes out to the property of Naboth the Jezreelite, and God is making his point in a very vivid way that this was such a heinous crime that the rectification of this crime is going to be undertaken right on the property of Naboth. So what happens is Jehu kills the king of Israel, Joram, and they just toss his body on the property of Naboth, the son of and on his very property. And they take care of that. He's put onto that piece of ground. And then he keeps moving on. And he comes upon Ahaziah, the king of Judah, who's going up to meet the king who has just been killed. And so what does Jehu do? He kills the king of Judah as well, because he's a descendant of Ahab and Jezebel. So he kills him. And continues to basically kill all of the descendants of Ahab. He moved as Jehu is going forward in 2 Kings chapter 10. It tells us that Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, and Jehu wrote and sent letters in Samaria to the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to those who reared Ahab's sons. And he said, basically, you can choose to fight me, or you can join me, and if you're going to join me, then you need to kill Ahab's sons. So they figured, hey, two kings couldn't stop Jehu. We're certainly not going to be able to do so. So what did they do? They killed the 70 sons of Ahab, and they cut their heads off and put them in two baskets and gave them to Jehu. I mean, this is a gory, grisly thing as Jehu's going through the nation. So they killed all of these 70 sons, and then they began to continued on. And they killed these 70 sons, and in these two baskets, they put them there by the gate. In 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 11, it says, Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men and his close acquaintances and his priest, until he left him none remaining. So he took care of the priest, took care of his close friends, and all of his remaining acquaintances. And so he basically wiped out every vestige of Ahab in the city of Jezreel. And then he moves on to the city of toward the city of Samaria. And on the way, he met these these brothers of the king, of King Ahaziah, the king of Judah, met them along the way, and he asked them who they were, and they said, well, we're going up to Jezreel to see Jezebel and Ahab, and, you know, they were all relatives, so they were on the way up there, so that wasn't the right thing to say, so Jehu killed them too. So he killed 42 men and left none of them there where they met. Then they Jehu continues on, and he goes to Samaria, and he invites all of the prophets of Baal and all of the worshipers of Baal to the temple of Baal there in Samaria. And as they're all invited and they all come, he sets men to with the duty of killing all of the individuals who are gathered in the temple of Baal there. So they killed every last one of them, and then they took out the sacred pillar of Baal, and they tore down the temple of Baal and made it a refuse dump. So basically, they just wiped out every last vestige of Ahab and Jezebel, and made a just completely cleaned up the whole mess that Ahab and Jezebel had established. He didn't clean out everything, because the daughter of the mother of Ahaziah still reigned in Judah, but her life is going to come to an end fairly soon, and eventually they'll kill Jezebel as well. So So Jehu did exactly what God commanded him to do, but he didn't go all the way. So he was very diligent in wiping out all of the every last vestige that he could find of Ahab and Jezebel. He did exactly as God directed him, but he did not go all the way. He was not willing to get rid of the golden calves that you found at Bethel and at Dan, and to turn Israel back to the worship of the true God. He figured he had done enough, and he was unwilling to go all the way and get rid of these idols and turn Israel back to the worship of the true God. So as you look at what takes place here, we have to understand that the kingdom of Judah had only one dynasty during its entire history, and that was the house of David. But as you look at Israel, it had seven different dynasties, and they lasted a shorter time. And it wasn't long after this that the whole nation fell to the Assyrians. So this brings us back to Hosea chapter 1, verse 4, where it says, "Call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel on the house of Jehu." So why did God place a curse on the house of Jehu? Well, because he did not fulfill what God wanted him to do completely. Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of God of Israel with all his heart, for he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, who made Israel to sin. So, yes, he was obedient up to a certain point, but to be obedient up to that point and then not complete the task is still to fall short and doesn't get you very far. So, Israel continued to follow the path, the worship of the golden calves, and God said that he's going to destroy that and punish Israel as a result. So we spent the time in this study because we have examined the examples that we can find here. We tried to understand the background here to lay the groundwork for the rest of the minor prophets, which we will continue next time. So the next study that we'll have next week, we will finish the book of Hosea. So the book of Hosea is 14 chapters long. We got nine verses. So hopefully, and you may be saying, well, I don't think he's going to finish it next time, but we will, trust me. So anyway, we'll finish that, and hopefully you found it profitable. I mean, when you go back and look at these things, it's historical, but he's also telling you something about why God took the actions that he did. And as you look at our own country, it has a meaning and a purpose for our age today, because we have these abominable things going on in our country, and there's coming a point where God is not going to allow it to continue. As I said on Sabbath, the point was made that everything that's going on is baked in. It's not something that's going to change, it appears. And if it's baked in, then, you know, that's a very serious condition to be in. You're in a condition that was very similar to that of Ahab and Jezebel. And that was a dangerous time. And you look at what's going on in our country. And we also realize that God rules, and God is very aware of what's going on and how this is going to play out. I don't know exactly, but we do know God is going to say there comes a point of no return when God says, okay, that's enough. And then God will carry out his will and exact whatever vengeance he feels is appropriate. So not to make everybody depressed, I mean, when you look at this, you may say, wow, that's a lot of people that died. And yes, it was. But God felt that it was appropriate to do because of the reprehensible behavior of the rulers of Israel. So I hope that you've found it profitable, and we will continue and finish the book of Hosea next time. So I appreciate your attention and all of you that were able to join today, and hopefully you found it profitable.